Involvement with the criminal justice system is life-changing. It matters.
Having a justice system that works is a really important part of a democratic society.
I'm Penelope Gibbs, Director of Transform Justice.
I'm Rob Allen. I've worked in and around criminal justice all my career.
This is the Transform Justice podcast, throwing light on the criminal justice system.
Hearing from people who know.
It's about whether the system's fair.
And what can be done to make it better.
Hello. Today we're going to talk about open justice. That's the ability of members of the public and the media to know what's going on in our courts. Having fought tooth and nail to get into magistrates' courts during the COVID lockdowns, it's a subject close to my heart. I'm joined by Rob Allen and by two people who spend a lot of time in courts: Sansha Berg, correspondent for BBC Radio, and Celia Kitzinger, co-director of the Open Justice Court of Protection Project. Rob, what are your initial thoughts about this subject?
I was struck in our very first podcast about the single justice procedure, how hard it is for people to find out what cases are coming before the court, let alone observe how decisions are made. But on the other hand, there do seem to be quite strong reasons not to allow public access to certain kinds of hearings, youth courts, for example. And I suppose, as with many things, it's a question of where you draw that line.
Indeed, indeed. Celia, for most people, they have no idea what the Court of Protection does. Can you use an example, talk about the kind of cases that the Court of Protection deals with?
So the Court of Protection is designed to protect the lives, the well-being and the autonomy of people who are deemed to lack capacity to make decisions for themselves. And those can be decisions about anything from where they live to the kind of care they received, the contact they have with other people, and medical treatment. And an example that comes to mind is someone in her 50s who had developed an ulcer on her foot, which was going to kill her. It was kind of gangrene going up her leg, and she did not want to have an amputation, which would mean, the doctor said, that she would die within 6 to 12 months. So the job of the court was first to determine whether she had capacity to make that decision for herself. And there was a lot of uncertainty about her ability to do that because she had delirium as a result of the infection. And she also had schizophrenia. And she was struggling with understanding the concept of death, for example, and that it was forever. Also, though, when she had had capacity to make her own decisions, she had consistently refused over a 5-year period to have an amputation. I mean, the tragedy in this case was actually that nobody had supported her to write an advance decision to refuse this treatment when she had capacity to make it. So it was now a best interest decision before a judge in the Court of Protection, who heard from a lot of witnesses, a lot of different doctors, and the decision that he came to ultimately was that it was not in her best interests to have an amputation, because it overrode the autonomous decision she had made when she had capacity, and because it would radically change her life in ways that would really matter to her.
And just to clarify with a case like that then, it was the NHS, the hospital, who wanted this decision made because they felt that there was a good reason to actually operate.
Medically, to save her life, it was indisputably the right thing to do. But of course, if we have capacity, we can refuse treatment even if we put our lives at risk by doing so.
It's obviously a really difficult case. Can I ask you, Celia, what prompted you to become interested in the Court of Protection and set up the programme that you have, which enables members of the public, as I understand it, to observe what's going on there?
So there was a transparency project in the Court of Protection in 2016, which enabled both journalists and members of the public to attend and observe, and very few people actually did so. In June 2020, when, along with disability rights campaigner and academic Gillian Loomes-Quinn, I set up this project, it was the outcome of another very difficult case. So I'd been supporting someone whose father was receiving clinically assisted nutrition and hydration, so the feeding tube, after a stroke, and she believed that he would not have wanted to receive it and would have wanted to be allowed to die. So she had brought a case to court, and the court hearing was scheduled 24 hours into the very first lockdown of the COVID pandemic. And it was the first all remote hearing of the Court of Protection. The court used Skype. The judges and the lawyers were very distracted by the technology. They kept having to deal with glitches. The judge left the hearing twice to go and deal with dogs barking when the doorbell rang. It was simply a completely unacceptable experience of a court hearing. I was horrified. The barristers involved wrote blogs about it afterwards, congratulating themselves on how well it had gone. So we wrote a blog explaining what it was like from our perspective. That led to some changes in the Court of Protection, some guidance. And also I then started watching other Court of Protection hearings in order to make sure that this wasn't happening in other hearings. I started blogging about them, tweeting about them, and I was just amazed at the extent of public interest. So particularly from social and healthcare practitioners in the NHS who said, how do I get to observe a hearing? And since then, we've just supported literally thousands of people to observe Court of Protection hearings. And we've published more than 350 blog posts about these court hearings.
So from your point of view, what would you say the most important thing you're trying to achieve is?
I think it's changed over the course of the project. I think I've come to believe in the constitutional principle that justice should be done and be seen to be done. Lawyers tell us that observers do mean that the judge behaves better, that they all behave better in court. I think the one other thing that's been really important is that families with vulnerable people and families who are themselves involved in Court of Protection hearings have contacted us to say, I would like to observe a court hearing because I'll be in one next month or sometime. And so that enables people to prepare for their own court hearings.
Sancha, you've reported yourself on the Court of Protection and more recently on the opening up of the family courts. These used to be almost secret courts in the past, weren't they, family courts?
Well, family courts hold hearings in private, so reporters have been able to go into family court hearings, but we can't actually report anything unless the judge gives express permission. You say they're opening up, but actually it's only a pilot in three court centres, which is Leeds, Cardiff and Carlisle. So that's a very small scale, but it is hugely significant because what this pilot, which started at the end of January, allows us to do is behave as we would in other kinds of court. So we can go in and we can take verbatim notes of what happens in court and publish those. We can speak to families, which is an absolutely crucial thing that we haven't been able to do at all before. The third thing is that we have access to court documents like the case summaries, which allow us to understand these cases properly for the first time and report them. And we can report all of that, provided that we keep the families anonymous, which is of itself quite challenging because it's quite possible that a family or their community, their friends might easily be able to identify themselves if you name the number of children, the sex of the children, the age of the children, for example, involved in cases, the location. Somebody can put that jigsaw together and say, aha, I know who that family is. So it's our responsibility to make it extremely difficult for people to identify the family. But having said all of that, you said secret, Penelope, that is exactly the word that's often used by people caught up in these cases. They feel that they can't talk to people outside the court, that nobody understands what's going on there, that there is no scrutiny, that if you can open up the court and show people the way the processes work, I think that that's a fantastic thing.
Sancha, can you give an example of the kind of case that you've observed in this new pilot?
I think the best example was a case we followed where a local authority was requesting a placement order so that it could place a young child, a toddler, for adoption. And the child's mother was fighting against that. The child had been in foster care for about 18 months, and the mother wanted her to stay in foster care so that she would have the time to access therapy that had been recommended by the court-instructed psychologist. And the judge, at the end of it, decided that the little girl should be placed for adoption. But at times it had seemed quite a finely balanced case, because the mother said that she had made the changes in her life that the social workers had requested, that she hadn't been able, however, to access this particular therapy in time for these court proceedings.
So the court says to the parent, we think this therapy would, as it were, help you in your process of trying to keep your child, but on the other hand, doesn't help them in any way find a therapist or get free therapy or anything like that.
Well, you could say that that's not the court's role. I mean, the court can't order, as I understand it, that the therapy takes place. It's the psychologist instructed by the court who recommends this. It's also, in certain circumstances, determined that the mother or father has to have this therapy in order to have a chance of getting her children back. And in this case, the barrister for one of the parents, actually for the father in the case, described it as cruel that she should be told, have this therapy, but there was no way she could actually access it.
I mean, perhaps I can take a step back and ask, I mean, aren't the good reasons for dealing with these very personal and troubling cases involving highly vulnerable people behind closed doors and in private? Isn't there something to be said for that?
Well, that's why the anonymity requirement is absolutely essential. You know, if we breach it, we're in contempt of court. We could face imprisonment, a fine. You're absolutely right. There is a question over the vulnerability of the people. But to my mind, that makes it all the more important we have responsible reporting. Because in many cases, if a parent, for example, thinks that a faulty decision has been made, there is absolutely no way that they've been able to highlight that before now. If they speak to us as reporters, they're in contempt of court. Trying to appeal a decision is an incredibly expensive process. There's no legal aid for these families. So I spoke to a mother 4 years ago who'd managed to raise money to successfully appeal another adoption placement order. And she told me that she'd had to raise something in the region of £60,000, which for people involved in these cases, who are often, as you say, the most vulnerable, there's no way that they could raise the money for an appeal like that.
I find it absolutely terrifying, the idea that these cases would be heard exclusively in secret, because they involve huge human rights issues like, well, we've talked about life and death issues, but there's also deprivation of liberty, restrictions of contact between family members, treatment without consent. So these are major human rights issues that need to be available to public scrutiny.
And I would also say, as many judges have said, that the decisions made in family cases are the most drastic actions taken by any court. There is, in many cases, for many people, such an atmosphere of fear around these family proceedings that people will go on the run, give birth outside a hospital, go to another jurisdiction because they are so terrified that the court is going to take their baby away. So I think it's really important that we do open them up, but absolutely critical, as you say, Rob, that it's done in a way that protects the identity of the families at the centre of these cases.
So, Celia, just to clarify, when you or other people who go and observe the Court of Protection say anything about what you've seen, can you just use the names, the real names of all the people and say whatever you want?
No, we are subject to what's called a transparency order, which is a rather Orwellian term for a reporting restriction order, which almost always protects the identity of the person at the centre of the case and their family, and often the names of the treating doctors.
But do you think that's right? Or do you think the names should be used of everybody involved in the cases?
I think names should be used where people wish them to be used and where there is evidence that the person at the centre of the case would wish them to be used.
Of course, there are people who do want to be identified, and you have to understand that the judge is going to look at that and You have judges who are extremely keen on transparency, extremely helpful, and then you have others who are extremely suspicious and sceptical of it. So this is very much a work in progress, I would say. And the family court pilot only affecting three court centres, it will be interesting to see what happens if it's deemed a success and extended elsewhere.
And also if it's extended to include members of the public. I, at the moment, am not eligible to observe family court hearings.
Yes, it's only accredited journalists and legal bloggers at the moment.
And legal bloggers means lawyers, not members of the public who blog about law.
And the other thing to say is that initially the family court pilot is only covering care cases, public law cases. But what it isn't covering is the vast majority of family cases, which are so-called private law. This is where parents are separating and can't agree about their children, where they should live or where they should live most of the time. So these are cases often with allegations of domestic abuse, often where people are trying to represent themselves in court, which can be quite a difficult thing. The pilot is going to move to cover private law cases, I understand, at the end of May. And that's, I think, when a lot more people will get interested, because they're more likely to have been involved in a private law case than a public law one.
But Sancha, this is a really interesting one about who has access. So I'm a former journalist, but I don't have any J membership now. Celia has expertise in the Court of Protection. So Celia and I can both go into these Court of Protection cases, and as long as we abide by the rules, we can watch them, we can report on them. Is it really right that we can't do the same in family courts just as you can?
This is a pilot. If it goes well, then it could A, be expanded across all the family courts in England and Wales, and B, I'm sure they will consider who's allowed access and how that might work. But I think you have to bear in mind that after many, many years, decades of people trying to open up the family courts, this is the most significant step so far. And you know, many judges, as I say, are a bit fearful of it. So they're going to take it step by step.
It's ironic, isn't it, that it's the Court of Protection that attracted all those charges from the media of being a secretive and sinister court that actually opened up to the public in 2016. And from everything I hear about the family courts, is by comparison a wonderful place for those of us who believe in transparency. And despite the variation between judges in their commitment to it as an ideal, it's very clear that there's leadership from the top to ensure that cases are transparent and that the public can get in, despite all of the problems we experience in practice.
Is it a question of scale, though, Celia? Because there are coming up to 250,000 cases in the family court every year now. So how many are there in the Court of Protection?
There are between 20 and 30 every day.
So that's 100 a week. Yeah, so very, very much smaller.
I mean, you've touched on this a bit, Sancha, but I mean, what has been the thing that has really pressured the change? I mean, is it pressure of people who had a decision go against them, really, and have been unhappy about it, wanting to bring that into the public domain? Or is it a pressure for exploring or uncovering what's going on in this area of the law?
It's interesting, because I'm not sure it is so much individual cases as a sense by the judiciary that there is a failure of confidence in some quarters in the system, where you have people running away to other jurisdictions or mothers giving birth in really inappropriate places. And there is also, of course, growing concern about child protection. If you consider the highest profile cases we've had in recent years are awful cases of child deaths, failure of child protection services, or at least that's the way it's been cast. So I think, you know, there's certainly pressure in that sense. The courts want to show how they do their job. But also you have judges in the system who really believe in open justice and think that justice has to be seen to be done. And I suspect that what's happened in the Court of Protection, Celia, has shown some of the judges that actually you can do it and the world doesn't end.
Celia, going back to this openness point, even in the Court of Protection, it's not all open, is it? There are hearings which are closed, plus also hearings which you have only heard about inadvertently, which were, as it were, secret. Can you tell us about those?
So about, I would guess, 90% plus of hearings are open to the public and to journalists. So I have quite a lot of confidence that when judges decide to make cases private, they are doing that for good reasons. A separate issue is the issue of closed hearings, where one of the parties and their legal representatives, if they have them, are excluded by court order deliberately. And it's usually family members who are not told about the hearing, not invited to be there. And of course, members of the public and journalists are not eligible to attend those hearings. Some of them involved forced marriages or abuse cases, where what the hearing is doing is asking the judge to order that police and the social workers can go to the family home and remove the person. So you don't have the family in those hearings, because if they knew about them, it would undermine the purpose of the hearing itself. And again, I think there are legitimate reasons for holding those hearings. The one that really shocked me and the one that really shook my faith in the justice system was a different kind of closed hearing, where a young woman in her 20s had primary ovarian insufficiency, which means she wasn't producing hormones to go through puberty. She was refusing to take hormones. And her mother said that she would support her daughter's choice while trying to persuade her daughter that it would be a good idea to take these hormones and go through puberty. The court, however, came to the conclusion that the mother did not intend to support the daughter in coming to a decision to take this medication, and that she in fact was exerting coercive and controlling behaviour over her daughter and was trying to keep her sort of small and childlike. There was then a court hearing at which the daughter was taken into care, and subsequently restrictions were made such that the mother could not visit her daughter and could not see her in person over video screen. This went on for 2 years. During these 2 years, there were hearings that I attended at which the mother was saying, please let my daughter come home. Has she agreed to take the hormones? And the doctors would say, no, she hasn't agreed. So the mother was saying, I will talk to her. I can probably persuade her, but only if she's home. The daughter hated being in care. She was unhappy. And we wrote a blog saying, well, this is baffling. We don't understand why it is that this daughter can't go home to her mother. It turned out that behind the scenes, there had been a closed hearing at which a judge had authorised covert medication of the daughter. So the hormones to put her daughter through puberty were provided in food and drink. The daughter did not know she was taking them. The mother was not told. So this was the reason, of course, why she was being kept in care, because she was receiving this medication. And this all came out after 2 years of these parallel closed hearings at which the covert medication was being organised and reviewed, and open hearings at which the mother was saying, please can my daughter come home. I found that absolutely shocking. And in terms of open justice, it meant that we had reported incorrect information, misleading information. As a result of our interventions, the Rules Committee looked at what had happened. The Vice President, Hayden at the time, wrote new guidance on closed hearings, in which he said, in general, it would be difficult to see parallel closed and open hearings as compatible with people's human rights and the right to a fair trial in particular. So I think that in itself is quite a powerful story in terms of demonstrating the value of having observers in the Court of Protection.
Mm. I mean, can I just check something about these kinds of cases? I mean, obviously, when they get into the higher courts, then rulings are written up and published and made accessible in anonymized form. With more routine cases, the kind of cases that are happening every day, are decisions written down and made available publicly in some form or another?
Not routinely, absolutely not.
But I think, Sancha, you said that there had been a suggestion by Lord Justice Mumby that would be a good idea in the family court, but it's not being done.
So he did issue guidance to that effect, and there were a number of judges in certain areas who did try to routinely publish their judgments anonymised, but it takes a lot of time, and judges are under quite a lot of pressure at the moment, and they don't have the time or actually the expertise to properly anonymise these judgments. And I know it's part of this pilot to encourage more publication of judgments. They're going to try and set up a system where they can be anonymised by some third party to make it easier for the judges. But it's going to be quite hard, I think, for the family court pilot to really work in terms of lots of stories being covered, because I think journalists haven't been able to actually find cases to report. We've done a lot on the BBC, but that was because we had the time to be in the court and follow cases on spec. Now, nobody really has time to do that. And the listings will tell you almost nothing. It's a list of letters and numbers. You've got many, many cases every day, care cases, and you have no idea which one is worth your while going into.
But Sanchia, the Court of Protection routinely does include information about, for example, whether it's a directions hearing or a final hearing, whether it's an urgent hearing or a routine hearing, the length of the hearing. Still, there are no journalists in the court apart from Brian Farmer. It's the what's in a name thing. Journalists come into hearings when the name is available, when people are allowed to use the name. Whereas members of the public, for us, it tends to be that we're interested in the issues, we're interested in the human rights at stake, we're interested in the principles of how these decisions are being made and the process whereby they're named. For us, the name of the person at the centre of it tends to be much less central. And I think that is one of the reasons why members of the public keep coming to these hearings and journalists simply don't.
Brian Farmer, who Celia mentioned, is this very, very experienced Press Association court reporter who over the last 10 years or so has spent a lot of time in the Royal Courts of Justice, going into hearings. He's been into quite a lot of family court cases, court of protection. And these will be stories that he has to write anonymised. They go out on the Press Association wire and you will see them very often picked up everywhere. And they are picked up because people will recognise the issues, that how important they are, Celia.
But he only goes to tier three hearings in the Royal Courts of Justice. I mean, that's a tiny percentage of the hearings in the Court of Protection. Most hearings in the Court of Protection are heard by district judges. And they're mostly about things like people with dementia who are in care homes that they don't want to continue to live in. They're largely deprivation of liberty that matters that come up. They're not sexy. They're not the sorts of issues around life and death that attract media interest, and yet they are the issues that will affect most of us at some point, either directly or in our families, because many of us will get dementia. Many of us may lose capacity at some point around fairly mundane but really crucial decisions about our personal liberty. For me, this is central to indicate to people how the Court of Protection could affect all and any of us.
But also, I would say, just going back, that the media, particularly local media, really is in such a state of crisis. They're not reporting criminal cases often that they used to report. They're not sending reporters to the courts routinely. And the idea of for a local editor to send a couple of journalists to these courts where, as you say, you won't even be able to give the name, no, they're just not interested. Not even the Yorkshire Post has been sending reporters to Leeds Family Court.
And I'm very aware also of the problems with the committal hearings that we get in the Court of Protection. So many people don't know the Court of Protection can send people to prison. And the people that it sends to prison or threatens to send to prison are mostly family members who've breached the orders that have been made by the court. So they've done things like written blog posts and made media statements about their loved one, because they think what's happening is wrong and they want people to know about it.
And they've named them.
They've made them identifiable, because if you stand up and say, my daughter is in this situation, then you are making her identifiable.
Mm. It's fascinating stuff with so many different ramifications, this issue, that certainly I hadn't thought about. But sadly, we do need to draw things to a close, I think. And I guess you would both say that there's some way to go still in terms of opening up the courts. Can I ask each of you in turn, if you were Lord Chief Justice or Lord Chancellor and could do one thing to improve scrutiny of the courts that you're interested in, what would that be? Celia, you go first.
I'd invest a lot more money in the court system. A lot of the problems that we're encountering are because of insufficient court staff, insufficient training, and judges who are deeply committed to transparency but can't deliver because they don't have the infrastructure available to do that.
Sancha?
It would be to say that journalists can join hearings remotely. At the moment, in family court hearings, we can only join by video link if somebody is already joining remotely. But if journalists were allowed to join every hearing by video link, that would, I think, mean a lot more journalists listening to cases, getting the hang of them and trying to report these cases.
So, Rob, if you were Lord Chief Justice, I mean, I know you have some reservations about open justice, but what change would you make?
Well, I've been struck a number of times by the fact that the Court of Protection seems to be a bit more open, or a lot more open than the family courts, thanks in large part to Celia's efforts. So I wonder whether the sort of project that Celia has set up in relation to the Court of Protection could, in principle and in reality, be extended or be recreated for the family courts. Obviously, we have to wait for the pilots, and I hope that they are being thoroughly evaluated, but certainly it's the family court that needs more attention, I think.
Thanks, Rob, Celia and Sancha. And to find out more about Celia and Sancha's work, do look at our programme notes. And if you have an idea for a future podcast or guest, do drop us a line via email or Twitter. Thanks and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Goodbye.